3. Johnny headed the Marine attack plane slightly east of south and turned on his view screens. This co-pilot was new, from the French refugees in the Alps, named Pierre Solon. He was quite young, recently trained. He still had a little trouble speaking Cyclo. Usually, his duties consisted of simply shifting the mineside planes about, but as compound duty pilot, it had been up to him to deliver the ship to Johnny's house. He had not dreamed that in the next few minutes, he would be flying co-pilot to the Tyler and heading for Africa. He had started out all right, but when he saw how Johnny took off, he had become overawed. He had never seen a plane lofted that way, like firing a bullet. And now they were flying hypersonic at only 15,000 feet. Would they clear the French and Italian Alps?
"We are awfully low," he timidly offered.
"People in back," said Johnny. "Can't let them get too cold. Get to work with those view screens so we won't be running into any drones." Drones, drones, drones. All his life, Johnny had been being looked at by drones. It was no exception now. The Chatavarian defense system was only half complete. Despite buying the company, it was an expensive system, almost 3 times as costly as the one the small gray men had described, but it was about 10 times as good. Automatic blast cannon that fired 1,500 miles into space could shoot down a space fleet with one salvo. Atmosphere drones that fired. Space drones that patrolled orbits. Probes that scanned anything moving within 10 light-years. Real armor cable that would make every city untouchable. As the system was incomplete, a lot of emergency stand-in drones were about, and they were attracted to anything flying. A huge green flashing light was going on top of the plane, and the box there, newly installed, was sending out the code of the day, which was so fast and so scrambled and changing microsecond to microsecond that an attacker could not hope to duplicate it. If the drones didn't see and hear it, they'd shoot. Ah, yes, here came the Mediterranean emergency drones, 3 of them, shooting over to have a look. The co-pilot was slow, and Johnny tuned a knob to focus them. Chatavarian drones, all right. Each one had a big eye painted on its nose. But those big, staring eyes were not a Chatavarian fixation on decoration. A pilot would instinctively shoot into the center of them, and if a pilot did, the drone used the shot as a return carrier wave to send a surge back that blew up the attacker's own ammunition and thereby his ship. Don't shoot at one of those eyes. Nevertheless, they were a bit disconcerting, glaring out of the view screen. They nudged in like sniffing dogs, and then, satisfied by automatically cross-verifying with each other, they fell away and returned to their patrol sectors. The French pilot was looking back at the Alps. They hadn't hit any. But Johnny had his screens on the orbit drones now. They seemed to be disinterested, satisfied by the code of the day. And what was this? He had a space probe on the screen. He hadn't known you could see one. Was it hostile? Like any star drone or probe, these things had a lens that was made of a light magnet. This reacted on light beams and pulled them in from a zone many miles in diameter and concentrated them, magnetically corrected for aberration, into a spot smaller than a dot on paper. In effect, it made a lens many, many miles in diameter. The problem was too much light rather than too little, and they had blinders or filters that dropped into place to keep them from burning out their receivers or recording discs should they turn toward a sun too close. In that way, one could get magnifications into the tens of trillions. One of the contractors had drilled Johnny in on command controls, and a box of these existed overhead. Johnny flipped a switch and tapped the probe's receiver and shifted the image to his own central view screen. It was their own space probe, all right. He was looking at the co-pilot and himself behind their own view screen. Yet that space probe was over 10,000 miles away. It must be at the near end of a run. Friendly, so he threw the tap off. He didn't really think anybody would attack Earth now. The peace treaty had gone in, as promised, with claws. Very, very popular. The delegates had even taken home copies of the end of Cyclo and the death of Asart. The bank was shoveling out food loans like a waterfall. Consumer products had not yet begun to roll. That would take time. He hoped he could get at the secret of how one built a teleportation motor. That would open the door to a lot of consumer products. And even more important, keep the vehicles they had here operating. These planes wouldn't last forever. "Take over," he told the French pilot, Pierre, and went back into the body of the plane. Chrissy stirred herself and unwrapped a bowl.
"I'm afraid the venison stew might be cold now."
Johnny sat down in one of the huge bucket seats. Patty was down at the back of the plane, just sitting there, looking down. It worried him. Sometimes she went for walks at night. Sometimes he could hear her in her room crying. Because she was only 10, he had thought she would recover, but she hadn't. Mr. Tsung, he saw, was going to use this time-space to catch up with his diplomatic and social duties. For here he came with about 10 pounds of paper. Johnny put his attention on the stew. It wasn't cold.
"This week's dispatch box came in from Snouch," he said.
So that was what Dries was doing coming down from Zurich. Send the business matters down to the mineside office. It's their job.
"Oh, I did, said Mr. Tsung. "These are all social and diplomatic invitations to weddings, banquets, christenings, requests to address meetings."
"Well, thank them and tell them no," said Johnny.
"Oh, I have, said Mr. Tsung. "We don't have any trouble. We use a vocal reader, a vocoder, and a vocotyper. We can handle correspondence in about 18,000 languages now, but this is going to get heavier."
Here it comes, thought Johnny. Mr. Tsung's elder brother had been appointed chamberlain to the court of the chief of Clan Fergus. His younger brother was busy starting up a diplomatic college in Edinburgh. "You got another brother?" said Johnny, around a mouthful of stew.
"I am sorry that I don't," retorted Mr. Tsung. "I'm talking about the nephew of Baron von Roth. He wants to apprentice as a diplomat in my office."
"Fine," said Johnny. Mr. Tsung adjusted the vocoder volume higher as the plane was roaring more with Pierre at the console.
"I want to hire about 30 more Russian and Chinese girls to train as clerks and vocotyper operators. It's really very simple. One reads invitations with a vocoreader into one's own language, and then one uses a vocoder to talk to the vocotyper, and it types the answer back into the tongue of the original letter."
"Go ahead," said Johnny.
"I think there should be a new building to take care of all these people and files. Something more on a Chinese..."
"Go ahead," said Johnny.
"There was one letter that I pulled out that you should see," said Mr. Tsung. "It's from Lord Voraz to MacAdam with a copy to you, and Dries said MacAdam had to hear from you before he answered."
Trouble, thought Johnny.
"Voraz wants a formula to determine the validity of a commercial loan."
"That's not diplomatic or social," said Johnny.
"It's kind of diplomatic," said Mr. Tsung. "Voraz and MacAdam being who they are, one does not wish to see tensions. The whole problem is what consumer products should arms companies convert to. If they convert to the wrong ones, the whole program will fail, and the bank will have granted useless loans."
His own problem in a different dress, thought Johnny. He thought of the red ink of desperation defense.
"Intergalactic Mining," said Mr. Tsung, looking at the Voraz letter, "was sitting on hundreds of thousands of inventions that were on file in the Hall of Legality to prevent other nations from using them. I know this isn't diplomatic, but it could make a big diplomatic mess if the bank lends money to make the wrong products. Also, all the invention formulas are in Cyclomath."
Johnny had finished the venison stew, and he gave the bowl back to Chrissy. There was something in the old man books about this. What was the subject? Marketing is a factor in profit. "You tell MacAdam to have banks get out survey teams, people that go around and ask people questions, and find out what people in each planetary area think they would want to buy. Not what they should buy, but what they want to buy. Don't offer suggestions. Just ask them. For all they know, it might be as little as a... He recalled his own discovery that glass would cut. As something to skin hides more easily. The subject is marketing surveys. And I'm working on cyclomath right now. Tinny had been listening. She was already punching phone buttons. This was a new system. But it was kind of overdone. The smallest exchange the Chatavarians made for a planet had 2 billion individual radio channels. And since the war, they only had about 31,000 people. There were radio phone printers everywhere. She was on to the Zurich bank, plugging in the recording she had just made of his voice. Tsung saw Johnny wasn't going to say more, and nodded to her, and she let it start. The printed reply would be rolling off onto McAdam's desk right now. She fed in the reference letter Tsung gave her.
"Dries left you this?" said Mr. Tsung.
He handed Johnny a little blue disc with a pin on the back of it. It said, Galactic Bank, on the front of it. When he saw Johnny looking at it, but not taking it, he added,
"The Chatoverian Deadly Device Officer passed it."
Johnny took it. "He give you anything else?"
"Oh, you know Dries," said Mr. Tsung. "He said there was an excess supply of butter up in the highlands now, and he brought Chrissy a whole bucket of it. Some old woman has 15 Holstein cows, and he says he's financing a butter business."
Johnny laughed. There had been no Holstein cows in Scotland that he knew of. Dries must have persuaded a pilot to fly them up from Germany or Switzerland, where they roamed wild. Another peppermint industry. "Do we give him anything in return?"
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Tsung. "We always feed him a tub of fried rice. He loves it. And my son-in-law found a book of colored plates of fish, and he made up some fish medallions, and we give him one of those each time. He says they are valuable."
"And you pay Lin Li," said Johnny, wise to the ways of commerce and the Chinese.
"Of course, from your social petty cash."
The term petty cash could be pretty general. The Earth Planetary Bank was paying for Earth's defense system out of petty cash. But Mr. Tsung was going on.
"That button is a pre-run of prizes they are giving out in their new neighborhood bank program all through the universes. You know, to people who open up accounts. It will in each case be in the local language. You put it on your collar tab or a place like that, and then you hum a note, and as long as you move your mouth, the button will sing. They are gathering up all the folk songs of each local region."
Johnny got a kit out of his bag. He had brought it to help the project he was on right now. He took a micro-annealer and opened the button up and looked at its insides with a micro-viewer. It was just a molecular-sized set of storage cells with little triggers and relays. A tiny battery charged itself from room heat. An electron-vibrating prong set atmosphere molecules in motion to make sound. Simple. Rather cheap. But that wasn't what Johnny was looking for. He often suspected the bank acquired information in peculiar ways, and he checked vocoders and such like to make sure they didn't contain a radio mic or a recording thread that could be taken back later. He had never found one so far, but that was the world he now lived in. He micro-annealed it back together and hung it on his buckskin collar.
"That isn't a standard one, he said to tell you,"
piped Mr. Tsung through his own monotone vocoder.
"He collected some old records of American ballads and put them in it. There aren't very many Americans, so it won't be manufactured for them."
Johnny cleared his throat and moved his mouth. The button hummed a wordless tune. Hadn't he heard that tune before? Scottish? German? Ah, it was called Jingle Bells. Then the button sang,
Galactic Bank, my friend so tried and true. Oh, what fun it is to have a neighbor such as you.
And then, in a proud voice, it said,
I am a customer of the Galactic Bank.
Well, that certainly wasn't any American ballad. Was Dries having a joke? He never joked, really. A very serious, small gray man. Johnny was about to take it off, but his laugh started it up again.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the buffalo play.
Johnny remembered you had to keep moving your jaws to make it sing. Saliva pops or muscle tension or something. He started moving his jaws again.
Where there seldom is heard a discouraging word. Mr. Tyler,
came through the intercom from the nervous Pierre.
I can see Lake Victoria on the viewscreens through the overcast. It's totally clouded in ahead. Hadn't I better go on to Kariba?
Johnny went forward and took over the console. It was always overcast at Victoria. Johnny opened his mouth to call in for clearance, but the button sang,
And the skies are not cloudy all day.
What a lousy forecast, thought Johnny, and put the button in his pocket. 4. After glancing over the flying conditions, Johnny could not much blame Pierre. For a while now, they had been flying through the night, a fact which an experienced instrument pilot would not have thought about twice, and indeed, Johnny had scarcely noticed it. By looking very hard, and only then with trained pilot's eyes, one could just barely make out Mount Elgon rising above the black cloud carpet, for there was no moon, and such a peak became mainly visible because it blocked out certain stars. It was the screens which caused Johnny to forgive Pierre. So thick was the cloud layer below them that the view screens aimed at it were more snowstorm than image. You would actually have to know the shape of the lake and the compound to have any notion of what you were looking at. A lot of electrostatic disturbance. It must be raining like fury at the compound. Rain flicked with lightning. Pierre, however, was in a state of mind that wasn't asking for anything but to stand on solid ground. He could not read the screens. He could not see anything but some stars above them and blackness below them, a blackness lashed now and then by some internal flash. He thought they were done for if they tried to go down through that. Who knew what hill they would run into? He would have been petrified had he known that Mount Elgon was higher than they were flying, but mercifully he did not know that. Nor, even more frightening, that they had passed by a couple of peaks even higher. Magnifying his alarm, Monsieur Tyler had come back to the pilot seat and hummed a strange song. Mon Dieu! One did not sing when one faced certain death. Lunacy!